Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mallow, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 112, being recorded on the 27th of January, 2016. My name is Sujit Mello, and on Skype with me, I have my esteemed colleague, Evan Basilek. Kale has decided that he had to be in a more important meeting, so he's not going to be with us today. But I'm sure, you know, it's customer comes first, and it sounded like he had to be with the customer, so we'll let him go today. But it's good to have you this evening, Evan. I hope all is well.
So, you know, we had our blizzard for the winter.
Right.
You know, how did you guys get here? We got a whole 3 inches of snow. Oh, no. I heard you guys got a lot more up your way.
I had got about 2 feet.
Yeah.
Where we were in the
so yeah, so ours is ours
and whatnot.
And as actually today it's mostly melted, and my son finally went back to school today on Wednesday.
Wow.
So yeah, we take our snow pretty seriously back here.
But it was quite a bit of excitement. I'm glad everybody came out okay. No heaters broke down this time, so everybody kept warm. That was all good. So well, we have an interesting topic that you want to talk about today. But before we get that, let's just cover not much in terms of new news for this week. But there was one item which I thought you might find is right down your alley in the SQL Azure space. Would you like to talk about that, Evan?
Yeah, no, definitely. This actually caught my attention for two reasons. You know, and the first one is, you know, there's just some new 2SQL stuff in Azure SQL Database, which, you know, and these are some things that showed up in SQL Server 2016, the on-premises or the box version as well. You know, there's a time zone, so that it's kind of time zone, not just date time offset aware, but it's actually like knows the time zone name. And then there's some zip capabilities, compress and decompress, and then there's a I don't know why you want to do this, but apparently you can do even more accurate date diffs. You know, so I guess, you know, there are people that care about that, but, you know, I'm not sure that it must be fairly specialized stuff, but, you know, it is good to see. But the thing that caught my attention with this is this is all stuff that just recently showed up in SQL Server 2016. You know, one of the big things that we've seen in SQL Azure the last, you know, couple of years is they've been really closer and closer to feature parity with SQL Server on-premises. You know, they run on the same engine, but because the way it's implemented, right, there's a number of things that they couldn't expose, and they've been changing the implementation so that they can expose those features. And I think this is a great example of SQL Server 2016. I'm not sure that it's out yet. And yeah. I know it's in beta, but I don't think it's officially released yet.
So have they backported some features from 2016 to the existing SQL Azure version?
Well, that's the thing, is I don't think it's not necessarily a backport, right? So they run on the same core engine.
Okay.
So if anything, what you're getting is you're getting SQL Server 26 functionality. You know, that, and it's still a preview product. I just verified that on a production platform, which is Azure SQL Database.
That is extremely interesting. And you know, some of these functions that in this blog, we'll put it in the show notes, of course. I was reading them. I'm like, man, I would have killed to have these functions in the past. You could have no idea. I mean, the time zone thing, especially, right? Because the get date always gets you into trouble. It always returns the time zone. I think it's either central time, whatever the.
I think it's either server or UTC.
Oh, UTC, correct. Yeah. And now, just by giving a name, you can say like at time zone, blah, 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 and give it a name, you know, Eastern Standard Time or whatever you call the standard names, and it just return, it just does a conversion for you. I mean, how good is that?
Yeah. No, I mean, I've written code to go look up what the delta is between these different time zones, right,
yeah.
to call into .NET. So, yeah, so you're absolutely right. You know, but, you know, this is, like, this is, I mean, literally cutting-edge stuff because it's going to be in SQL Server 2016,
right.
but it's already in Azure SQL Database. I mean, that's just really cool, and that's what we can do with these cloud services, right? We can kind of release pieces and parts sooner than in the box product where really the whole thing has to be ready.
So, I mean, you know, obviously there's I'm not privy at least to the way that the actual multi-tenanted version of Azure is SQL Azure is implemented, but how do you deploy like a product like SQL 2016, for example, in even in a multi-tenanted mode, and not deploy all the functions on it? I wonder how they are able to provide these functions a piecemeal at a time, because normally, if you just install SQL 2016, you get everything, right? It's not like, click this button to get this select statement and click that button to get the time zone. It's not like that. You install it and you get everything. So how do they do that kind of piecemeal approach in the multi-tenanted mode is what I was wondering.
So I can't say, how are they doing it today, but I know when I used to support the product, what they were doing was it was the same code, right? Mm-hmm. Same code base, and everything was compiler switches, right? Turn on the if SQL Azure then this is on, and if SQL Server on prem, wherever the build was, then these features are lit up. And that's actually, to be honest, that's how we do a lot of things in Azure in general today. When something is kind of internal preview versus it's a private preview, kind of invite only, versus a public preview versus available for everybody, that code is always running in production.
Mm.
It's just a setting on your subscription as to whether or not you can leverage that, feature code, whatever it is. That's a part of the way that we can really, when we flip the switch for going to production on this stuff, that's part of how we really know that it's pretty solid, because it's not like this is new code that we've deployed. We're just giving everybody access to the code.
Yep.
Right. I'm sure that they're doing a variant of that, with Azure SQL Database these days. But it really is neat. I suspect these days it is probably 100% one code tree. I don't know for sure, but I would have to suspect it is.
So but they have special switches, as you said, a special flag somewhere to turn on and turn off certain functionality in there.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. It just reminds me of my days back before I was into programming. I used to fix supercomputers, like the Cray XMPs and the CDC.
What do you mean by fix?
Well, if someone had a problem with a supercomputer, they would call me, right? That was my job.
That's cool, Sajid. I did not know that about you.
Yeah, so that was right out of college, I started fixing supercomputers. And, one thing I learned about some of the CDC computers is that when you bought a supercomputer, you could pay, $25 million for it. And, you had it for, say, so many CPU cores, the equivalent of cores at the time. They would call them engines or something like that. You got it for 5 engines, okay? And now suppose you needed more engines. Well, so you pay another $10 million, right? And they send a guy over, and the guy comes over and he cuts one wire, or he just puts a plug somewhere on one of the boards, and automatically another 5 engines got enabled. So everything's in the box, right? It already has like the 25 engines in there, but only 5 of them are lit up because that's all you paid for. When you pay another $5 million, he comes and he turns on a switch and you get another 5 engines.
So literally a switch.
Yeah. Sometimes it was like a little wire that he would cut or connect or something like that. It's like, I can't believe it.
That's funny. I wonder, and I'm going to have to go do some research now, and maybe this is just a wild guess, but I wonder if that's where the switch statement originally came from.
Quite possible. So I was reminded of that when you just mentioned how they might be doing the SQL Azure stuff.
Yeah.
But this is cool. I mean, some of the other functions on that blog that we're going to put out there are really cool. Like the drop if exists, right? I mean, how many times we have code in there to say if something exists, then drop it, otherwise don't
Yeah.
drop it. I mean,
Yep.
drop if exists makes so much sense. And my favorite are the compress and the decompress. I mean, how cool is that? Like gzip compression, decompression, all in one statement. That's really super. So yeah,
Yeah.
glad these are all available in SQL Azure, and I guess they're in preview now, right? It's, as you said, this
No, actually for Azure SQL Database, they're fully released.
fully released. Okay.
Yeah.
So go and use them then,
Yeah,
guys.
exactly. Go play with them, and then maybe that'll give you some incentive to go buy SQL Server 2016. So.
There you go. So let's get to the topic of the day then. You had an interesting topic that you've been wanting to talk about for a long time. And it's something that you're close with in the networking space. So why don't you lay it out for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. And I totally upfront with everybody. This is, I don't have any special insight into this. I came ran across this article, and while the fact that it was networking, in my current role does appeal to me and is interesting, I really think what they did, the overall effort that they did, was really good. So there's this company by the name of, I guess it's Ilriad, I guess is how they pronounce it, Games, but they do Age of Ascent. Kind of a massive scale, not even just an MMO, but a massive scale MMO. And they're, very successful game, and they were trying to, they're always trying to figure out how do they make it faster and more responsive. And what they did was they actually did some testing on Azure, comparing, Linux versus Windows, and different, .NET versus C sharp or .NET versus C++. Some different ways of looking at things, trying to decide, okay, what could they actually achieve on the platform, right?
Okay, now this is you're talking about what can be achieved on the available VMs in Azure, right?
Well,
Kind
so
of.
it's they actually did it kind of at two levels. They did do one level of looking at, what they could do with different servers, but they also did, what they could do with different languages. And then what they could do with even different cores and the like for that point. So they, if you think about this, think about how difficult it would be in the on-premises world to, kind of build this test matrix of, hey, should I build my servers with more RAM and less CPU and maybe a faster hard drive, or should I do slower hard drive, less RAM, more CPUs?
Correct.
It'd be incredibly difficult in the cloud, and I'll give, Amazon props here. I mean, Amazon has the same capability. You can go and just kind of pick, I want to test this versus this, and here I have all my matrix.
Right.
And you don't have to put, it's not very, very easy to get this capacity.
Right. Now, I mean, of course, but when the reason I kind of hesitated a little bit earlier when you brought up the topic is networking is something that's typically very hardware specific, right? When I think of networking and high speed networking, I'm thinking, fiber connect or you're coming up with trying to come up with all these fancy technologies to get the most amount of bandwidth as you can, and we're trying to de make this work with I guess almost commodity hardware that's available in Azure or in Amazon, correct?
Yeah, and actually they're taking it one step further. They're using basically this commodity hardware, doing it with .NET framework.
Wow.
So really commodity with commodity, right? I mean, because again, kind of like you were saying, is not, if you it, traditionally, when you think about, hey, I have this, massive scale app, or something that has really, really stringent performance things. Probably some of the things you see in the financial markets, right? It's I'm going to go bare metal, and I'm going to do, as close to, core C++, as close to the metal as I can from a code perspective, right? Just
Kernel
get.
drivers and whatnot, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And what they really did is they said, okay, well, what can we do by using this, publicly available commodity hardware, so nothing special. Actually, some of it is special. You look at some of the higher end, G series and whatnot. I can't go get that in my lab. I don't know about you. So it's a little bit special, but anybody in the world has access to it, right? I don't have to be a special Microsoft customer to get access to that. And then they were actually using .NET I think it was .NET 4.6, running on top of Windows. So just, you know, really a plain vanilla, you know, ASP.NET, or I'm sorry, .NET framework running on standard Windows. So nothing unusual, especially basically commodity code on top of commodity OS on top of commodity hardware.
Yeah, and I know you mentioned ASP.NET, and I mean, typically when you talk of high-speed networking, I immediately think of low-level sockets or UDP packets or datagrams and things like that, right? I mean, traditionally, I mean, I've written in the stock trading world, you know, I've written my share of high-speed UDP broadcast systems for implementing, say, a ticker plant. You know, as stock prices are changing, you want to make sure all the data is getting updated to all the subscribers in real time. And so you always use those very low-level protocols because you want to be as fast and quick as possible.
Yep.
But you're saying that we're not going to be necessarily using that low-level protocol here.
Yeah, I mean, and think about it, right? I mean, I think everybody, nobody's going to argue with the statement that if I write really good C++ code, it is going to absolutely going to be kind of from a pure, you know, compiler statements perspective, it's going to be more efficient, less actual lines of compiler statements compared to managed .NET code, which not only, you know, do you have the managed code, but you have, you know, the whole layer of the actual .NET framework, garbage collection, all that kind of stuff, right? But, you know, I don't think anybody is going to dispute with you, although there's probably some C++ purists that are going to spam me on Twitter or something. But I think there are very few people in the world that will disagree with the statement that says, if I just want to sit down and write code to develop, to, you know, make some project, you know, I want to complete some, you know, activity, some app, some game, some, you know, some piece of functionality, I can probably get that written faster in .NET than I can in native C++.
True. I mean, there's a lot of features that .NET offers. You don't have to worry about things like pointers and memory collection, memory garbage collection, and what, you know, all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it's just it's also a more forgiving language, right? If I can't forget to dereference my pointer somewhere. Mm-hmm. Right, I just can't. The framework handles that for you, and the value proposition for those types of languages. I mean, Java's in the same boat. So is, you know, Perl, PowerShell, some of these other ones, where I can spend more time focusing on my business logic, my business problem, than actually like writing this perfect code, right?
Right.
And these guys did this, and even with my kind of networking background. Some of the stuff that they're doing is I kind of had to really read a couple times to kind of follow what their tests are. I mean, they're doing some really serious thinking about latency and throughput and everything at the networking layer. They were finding that .NET on Windows on this virtualized commodity hardware was doing very well. I mean, it wasn't the fastest, but it was, given the amount of effort it took to write the code, it was performed extremely, extremely well.
That's great. Yeah, and we're talking about now using more like a web server technology, correct?
It looks like, and again, I'm kind of interpreting some of the stuff that they did here, but it looks like they were 100% ASP.NET 4.6,
right?
So it's, you know, running inside, you know, it's sitting on top of HTTP sys, running inside of, you know, W3WP, you know, and some of that stuff that's going on. I think you might have had more experience with this than me, or maybe it was Kale. But like ASP.NET 5, I know we've rewritten to be leaner and faster.
Absolutely.
Kind of out of the box.
It doesn't have all the baggage that, say, a traditional .NET 4.6 has, you know?
Right,
It's slimmer and meaner, yeah.
Yeah, so the net result is you would probably get even better results than, you know, they got with 4.6. But yeah, they were just, you know, doing standard, you know, web calls in and out of this ASP.NET.
Right. Now they do. I've been looking at some of the source code that's linked, and they have all the source code for that .NET project up on GitHub over here.
Yep.
And there's a link to it. They've kind of built their own, I guess, HTTP server, right? Just to make things a little faster. It's of course very much async driven to handle that kind of load. But some of the numbers over here look pretty impressive in terms of transactions per second. I mean, you're talking like millions of transactions per second
Yeah.
in some
No,
cases.
absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it was interesting. I mean, the servers that they were doing for some of this benchmarking, they're doing these servers that are 18 cents an hour.
Wow.
Right? So these are not even like, I mean, this is just they were doing an Azure A2 instance with two cores for
That's
some,
not.
for kind of some of their benchmark testing. I mean, that's
That's the low
not,
end, yeah.
yeah. So I think part of this is, they really have, and they talk about this a little bit in the article, which is, if they found that, the code that they wrote wasn't quite fast enough, they could theoretically spend just a little bit more for some slightly better hardware. But it sounds like they didn't need to.
Yeah, and I guess the point, what they tried to do is to saturate the NIC, right? That was the kind of end goal for them. It's how can we saturate the NIC without exhausting the CPU?
I'm trying, I just lost. I had the Windows numbers. I'm looking at the Linux numbers where they had like, 412,000 requests per second. I lost the Windows numbers. I was scrolling through this. Let's see, what were they saying they were getting? Yeah, I can't find it, but they had it in here. But it was a comparable number. Right. Again, I thought this was a really good example of a company that, they have this product that, I don't know how they got to where they are, but now that they're at scale and they're trying to really kind of look at how do they, optimize their performance while minimizing their cost, right? Just like every other business, and maximizing their ability to iterate on features and functionality. They kind of said, let's throw all of the assumptions out the window. Let's go test. And, they did some really exhaustive testing and they walked away with, hey, we can potentially give up some complexity, not give up any performance, and, end up with kind of the same net-net. I mean,
Right.
that's a phenomenal, end result from this kind of work.
Yep. But I think the devil's also in some of the details over here, and they do talk about some of the settings that they have to set up in the NIC card. This one is the receiver side scaling. You have
Yeah.
to enable that. I guess
Yep.
that's disabled by default. So you go into the virtual network adapter settings, the Hyper-V settings, and you enable that. Another good point they make is that TCP/IP, in order to get that throughput, the TCP/IP throughput number that they want, the high number, you're eventually bound by latency, right? So
Right.
at least, I mean, obviously, if one of your test machines is in one data center and the other one's in another data center, you're going to suffer in that. So you at least have to try and get them as close to each other as possible.
Yeah, and the other thing that, and it's not clear if they actually kind of consider this, but this is something I've seen other people have to do. One of the realities of these kind of public cloud data centers is that performance is kind of, excuse me, performance is in a range, right? You're not going to get the exact same
It's
performance
not
every
guaranteed.
day, right? But you're going to tend to see it's going to kind of vary within some band. Right. So typically when I see people do this kind of testing, what I recommend is, hey, go do it, peak hours for yourself, off hours for yourself, do it in a couple different data centers, just kind of get a sense of, what this range would be. Do the testing over the course of a couple of weeks instead of just, a single day, so that you have a better understanding of the real world scenario to this. The other thing that I thought was interesting about this is they didn't really, I mean, they made some compromises in terms of, how could they simplify their tests so it was something they could actually do, right? But, a lot of times, I mean, I don't know about you, but whenever I've seen people do this kind of testing on premises, you see them make all kinds of, shortcuts. Hey, I'm running this one machine's physical and this one's a virtual machine. This machine's, its CPU is, 2 years old, and this other one's, the brand new, latest and greatest CPU. And that's not apples to apples.
It isn't. As a matter of fact, I'm surprised. You know, funny you should say that. Right now, I'm dealing with that at my customer. We're doing a name pipes, almost the exact thing that you're talking about, high speed networking, but it's related to name pipes. We're doing because name pipes is a little faster than TCP/IP if you're within the same box, right? So we're within the same box. We're trying to do
Because
from processor to processor.
it's map memory instead
Right,
of
it's map memory. And what we found is that they had a server box which is using some Xeon processor and a workstation box which has, an i5 core, four cores and all that. And it's very difficult to compare these two from a pure performance perspective. The workstation is actually performing much, much faster than the server. Okay? And it's difficult, like what's, I mean, how do you compare two completely different server types, right? Server family. It's very difficult. So you're right. I see what you're saying. You've got to be on the same level, at least if you have multiple servers involved in your test.
Yeah, I know one of the hardest cases that I ever worked when I was in the SQL Server space was, this kind of, not cases, but class of cases, is we would get, hey, upgraded to this brand new, thingamajig server, right? Fancy new expensive server, and my queries run slower. And what we would invariably find is that the customer's workload was a whole bunch of really, really short queries that were smaller than the quantum. So what would happen is it was basically driven by CPU speed. And typically these days, right, for I guess it's mostly for power reasons, but we tend to see more cores, slower clock speed than in previous days when it was all about clock speed, right? So you could actually, actually, I take back, I said that wrong. It's not that they were doing less work than a quantum. It's the amount of work they could do in a quantum,
Quantum,
right? Higher core speed, you get more actual operations run, right? For your customer, have you guys considered actually, doing your testing on, a couple, spin up a couple Azure VMs
We
and
did.
then you could test apples to apples?
We did. That's what we did is we spun up Windows 7. Well, they still use Windows 7 and Windows Server 20, 2008 in their case. And we put them on the same instance, VM instance, and the tests work identically. The results were exactly the same. So as long as you have the same hardware, the operating system didn't seem to matter.
Wait a minute. Does that mean, Suji, that you got to do actual Azure work for a customer?
Oh yeah. I mean,
Finally.
just to prove them wrong and what we had to I said because that's the best I said, we had to get VMs and like where am I going to get it? Oh, wait a minute. There's that thing called Azure, where I can just click a button and get two VMs and presto. So yeah, that worked out really good over there. And I just needed it for a couple of days and then brought them down. So didn't even cost much.
No, I mean I think that's one of the things that again, we've talked about this before. I mean that's one of the things that blows me away when I talk about Azure to people that are kind of new to public cloud is it's like, hey guys, you know what? Here, here's $50 in credit, because we can give out these little, credit card MS not MSDN free Azure credit. Go spin up a G5. Yeah, I know you're just a normal person, but go spin up a G5 because you can. Anybody can. I mean, that's just amazing.
Now, on this test, I noticed that Damian Edwards is involved. He's one of the guys, and I know him well because he's a very, he's one of the lead guys in the ASP.NET, the new ASP.NET team, the ASP.NET 5
Oh,
product.
okay.
And so he is one of the lead guys. He's been very, very instrumental to making that happen. Also, he's very instrumental with the whole SignalR framework, which is what is used a lot now for doing distributed, for distributing data like Ticker Plant and stock quotes and everything to multiple users or chat, making a massive chat network. So that's stuff that he is developing. There's a nice video that he's put up here showing some of the numbers, and the numbers are truly astounding, right? They're talking of 7.7 million requests per second. And the CPU is humming at 50%. It's not even taxing the CPU, okay? And the, but the NIC card is running at 8.5 gigabits per second, so it's almost close to saturation. And I think that's where you want to be, right? For these kind of scenarios, you don't want the CPU maxed out, but you want your NIC card completely maxed out.
Yeah, because I mean, well, because that I mean, if you're, you know, your end users are that network away from you.
Yeah.
Right. And you never want to hit, you know, it's, we used to laugh in the SQL space, right? I don't care if you average, you know, if your cap is 99.99%, as long as you don't hit 100 ever,
yeah,
you're doing great from CPU.
Exactly.
But you know, from a NIC perspective, the closer you can get to that 100, the better, right?
Right.
You know, because then you're taking full advantage of that.
Right. But yeah, 8.5 gigabits, that's pretty good. That's CPU. So,
yeah.
Impressive. And this is just, as you said, a very, you know, normal, ordinary hardware on Azure. Nothing special here.
Yep.
Good. So, yeah, so there's some nice tips in there on how to configure, as you mentioned, some of the settings that you want to configure in the NIC card are provided. Some of the TCP settings, mm-hmm. Some of the considerations are there, and a whole bunch. And the code is there. So anybody can pull down that code from GitHub and try it out themselves on their own VM instance if they want to verify some of these numbers and use it in their own applications. That
yep.
is so cool.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, I can see this being very useful, as you pointed out at the start, in the financial space, obviously, because you know, there's always that need to propagate information very quickly mm-hmm. out, and the NIC, you know, saturating the NIC card is the key over there. There's no doubt about that.
Yep. No, absolutely.
Cool. Okay, so we'll put this in the show notes, and if our listeners have any thoughts about this topic, or see any particular use for this kind of scenario in their own application or in their own space industry that they're currently in, and we'll be happy to hear from you guys, you know, so we can talk about it on the show and share your experiences with others.
Yeah, or even, you know, other people doing, you know, I don't care what resource or testing, disk, CPU, whatever. I mean, I personally find this kind of stuff really, really interesting because they're really thinking about what they're doing and being very deliberate. But yeah, anybody that's testing any of this kind of stuff, love to see the numbers, you know, especially if you're kind of doing a, you know, hey, what happens if I do this on-prem versus let me go use these kind of newfangled cloud things, you know, and just kind of share what you find.
Yeah, and one of the nice things about taking that approach where you spin up something in the cloud is, like in our case especially, you know, you don't know sometimes what the customer has on their servers, right? They have all these other third-party software, and you
right.
really don't know what interacts and what's slowing it down. You spin up an Azure VM, you're kind of getting it nice and clean, right? You know,
yep.
right off the bat. It's the premier experience right there. So mm-hmm. and the performance you get from there is always the best performance. And then you could determine, you know, what exactly is the difference and why it's not running the same way on premises. And in our case, we did actually find a lot of third party software that was slowing down our name pipes. So that was an interesting find right there.
Yeah, group policy wins again is usually the case, right? It'll put on, whether you like it or not, you're going to get what your group policy owners tell you you're going to have on that machine.
Yeah, but what really gets them in trouble is some of these protection software that you have from other companies, you know,
yep.
that are trying to protect the network stack or protect
yep.
the server, and that just comes in the way all the time. So that's something everyone should watch out for.
Yeah, I mean, those things serve a great need, but if you know, if you're truly going for, you know, as fast as possible, that is another component that has to touch and evaluate that packet.
Yep.
Right. So
exactly.
It has to slow it down.
It has
right?
to slow it down. It may be a driver, it may be written in C++, but it is going to slow it down.
Yep. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh.
So, no.
Great.
Cool.
This was a good discussion. Thank you for bringing it up, Evan.
Yeah, no problem. I'm really interested to hear that you used to fix supercomputers. That's awesome.
So, next week, I'll be going to Seattle this weekend. And we'll do a special edition of the show. I'll be out there. You guys will be here. We'll record on Sunday. And so that'll be interesting. We're going to get a special guest on the show as well, somebody who will be joining me in Seattle. So it'll be a good topic. I won't spoil it right now, but looking forward to having that discussion on Sunday evening.
Sounds great. Well, safe travels, Sajid.
Thank you.
Take care. Okay. Talk to you later.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.